Welcome, everyone, to our podcast, where we're going to be discussing the story of Mrs. R from Pathways to Pain Relief. We've had some great discussion about this story already on our forum, so I look forward to it. Just a reminder, I'd like to say at the beginning of all the calls, remember that this is not considered to be a substitute for professional medical or mental health advice. If you feel that you need some of those, we encourage you to get what you need. None of us are operating in the capacity of practitioners here. We are all peers discussing a book that we have all enjoyed. Bruce, we had talked briefly about summarizing the book at the beginning. Would you like to do an intro, or shall I start it up?
Okay. Today we're going to be dealing with the subject of our discussion is going to be Sessions with Mrs. R, which is a chapter which is part of Frances Sommer Anderson's contribution to Pathways to Pain Relief. And in this book, in the introduction, it presents Dr. Anderson's and Sherman are presenting clinical case material to illustrate how the musculoskeletal pain and other psychophysiologic disorders can originate from psychological experiences as a means to protect an individual from unbearable emotional distress. And this Sessions with Mrs. R chapter covers a 13-year period of therapy with Dr. Anderson, which proceeded from one to twice a week. And the central problem that was addressed was that Mrs. R found it impossible to experience feelings responsible for her musculoskeletal pain. She had a 40-year history of pain and had seen many specialists with no relief. And there are two sessions with Mrs. R that Dr. Anderson chronicles in detail. In fact, the first two sessions that she had with her. And her initial effort is to define the emotional context of Mrs. R's pain, since Mrs. R doesn't seem to have a clue about where this stuff is emanating from. For example, she's had, it's been the same for 40 years. She had foot pain since her oldest daughter's wedding 6 months ago, and also stabbing, gnawing pain in her right shoulder. She has four children, three girls and a boy. And there's a long pause in their conversation. And then Mrs. R mentions that she did have a first son, Stephen, with spinal bifida, and he lived 12 years. But before this interview, Dr. Anderson emphasizes that Mrs. R had never had a thought of him before. And then it comes out that she blamed his infirmity, his spina bifida, on mononucleosis that she had contracted during her pregnancy. So there's one source of her guilt coming out. And her husband, Mrs. R's husband, had placed Stephen in a residential facility setting without consulting her. There seems to be... I can't help but note that there seems to be an extreme disconnect between husband and wife. And Anderson wonders out loud, how could Mrs. R take it? Anderson goes into a commentary on experience common to all of her patients who'd rather have my TMS pain than tolerate this emotional pain. She speculates on whether Mrs. R is going to come back for a second session, which she does. But however, Mrs. R arrives elated. She played tennis for the first time in many months after talking about her first son. So that convinces her that she should proceed with the therapy. And then there's a second source of her repressed emotionality, the guilt about her sister, little sister Alexa, who was slightly retarded after an accident that she was present at. Although there'd been a nanny there, well, I think Alexa fell out of a window and hit her head. And now she had taken on the burden the rest of her life of taking care of Alexa. But Alexa was very narcissistic and self-centered. And this placed a great deal of stress on Mrs. R, too. And so this was a second source of her rage, taking care of Alexa, that Dr. Anderson emphasizes. So Dr. Anderson says that it's a combination of shame, guilt, and rage due to Steve, her firstborn son, and Alexa that are triggering this skeletal pain that she's been experiencing. And from there on, she goes into, Dr. Anderson covers the course of the therapy in a much longer section after she's got those two sessions out of the way. But at the end of the therapy, of the section on sessions with Mrs. R, Anderson concludes that she's helped Mrs. R complete the grieving process, and she's achieved the goal of liking herself for the first time, which seems to be the goal common to all TMS therapy. Finally come to the realization that you're fundamentally a good person. So do we want to take off from there?
Sure. Well, thank you for that.
That was awesome.
That was an awesome summary. Thank you. I agree. I thought that maybe a next step that we could talk about is Dr. Anderson has a series of questions that she asks in the middle of the chapter. I thought maybe we could reflect on some of those, and if people want to jump in, absolutely feel free. Currently, all of the mics are unmuted unless you've muted them yourselves. She says, as you read these examples, the examples that Bruce was just saying, and imagine yourself in Mrs. R's shoes, what would you feel and what would you do about what you feel? Could you allow yourself to feel furious at Alexa? Would you feel guilty having the thought of setting limits for her? I was just wondering, how would you guys feel? I mean, I think it would be challenging for me to be furious at Alexa. I think I had the benefit of actually having psychotherapy very early in my life because my mother died when I was young and she encouraged me to go to psychotherapy. And so I feel like I'm pretty in touch with my emotions, but I think I would have articulated it rather as being frustrated. I would say I'm very frustrated with my sister, but I wouldn't be able to tap into that part of me which just had primitive childlike rage. Does anyone else have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, it was like she, when she was a kid, the thing, she had a brother, right? And let me see how it goes. When she was a kid, okay, how would I feel angry? Okay, yes, before I learned all about the tense of thinking and all the worrying and the TMS healing therapy, I would have been angry, but not conscious of it. It would have just been boiling in the chatter in my head or something like that. And as soon as I heard that question, I knew that was me a year ago or 2 years ago. I knew that was me then. And I'm like, wow, this is touching home so much with so many people, of this chatter that goes on in our head, and we think it's just we really not even half the time paying attention to it, but it's just going and it's building this tension over and over and over. And in her case, I think she didn't have much chatter. She was kind of disassociated from it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we could look at it from a lot of different ways, but at the same time, with the question directed towards me, yeah, I know now that the anger would have been there unconsciously, but I think she fell out a window, her little sister, Alexa,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when that happened, then she sort of had it in her belief system, too, that she had to take care of her because she promised her parents that she would take care of her. So she had that ingrained in her, I would say that was in her subconscious, you know, just all the way in the back of her head. And if she didn't do it, she would feel guilty that way. And if she did do it, then she's in a rage. So, you know, with the therapist in there helping her, it was a big, big relief.
I think Dr. Anderson says...
I also identified with that. This, I'm in that situation right now. I mean, now I've got conversations in my head, but when I was young, I didn't. And I have a tremendous backup of rage and hate for my parents. I finished writing some stuff right before the call, and it just keeps coming out and coming out and coming out, and I have no problem letting her know it. I want it to come out, and I'm having trouble getting it out, and I'm still full of pain, but pain moves around, so I identify totally with what she's going
with that
through
story.
And
yeah. It feels like there's different stages. Like stage one is where you can't even reach the pain. Like you don't know what it is, and if people tell you that you have unconscious rage, you'll argue with them. You're like, no, I don't, of course not. And I think that's maybe why Dr. Anderson had to be so cautious as she was going through. That to me was one of the themes of this chapter, is how cautious she was and gentle. But then you get to this other stage where you can tap into it, and then it can be like overwhelming to let it out. And there's another situation where you have to be cautious and gentle to make sure that it doesn't become overwhelming, all of this rage. I'm sorry, Bruce, did I interrupt you?
Oh, it's just that Dr. Anderson says that during therapy with Mrs. R, that we linked some of her musculoskeletal pains to hateful, angry, often rageful feelings towards Alexa that she had been unable to experience prior to her work with me. Because these feelings did not fit with Mrs. R's image of herself as a patient, compassionate, and willing to fulfill her promises to her parents, they were banished to her emotional reservoir. And that seems to be to diagram the process of repression that was going on here in Mrs. R. And also why she needed to take care of other people so much. That was a defense, wasn't it?
Tell me about that. Just tell us about that.
Well, it was a defense against these angry feelings against her sister. So she was always caring for people. Wasn't that her daughter? She's always messing around, right? Worrying about other people's, other people are doing and what they think and so on. It's a way of distancing yourself from these angry feelings that are unacceptable socially.
Interesting. Okay, because I found actually a kind of a different cause, perhaps overlapping, which was guilt. I guess I listened to the story and I thought of how, you know, she wished that she had been, she felt so bad. She felt that she was supposed to be watching Alexa, and Alexa fell out of the window. Your sister falls out of the window, gets a concussion, and is never the same afterwards. And I felt like maybe there was unconscious guilt for that. I know I would feel guilty in that situation. And then another child in her care, her first child, her son, she can't take care of him. So
that was sad.
So she takes care maybe of pets, you know, of her dogs, and she takes care of her grandchildren when her daughter when she feels like her daughter isn't taking good enough care with the nanny, or she feels like the nanny isn't taking good enough care, because after all, the nanny had been overseeing Alexa and her when Alexa fell out of the window. She feels like she has to do this, and then she feels rage, kind of a consequent rage. If I can sneak one thing in, one thing which really... well, actually, I'll do it later. Did you want to respond, or did anyone want to respond to that before I change the subject?
I'm on the same page with you. I agree totally what you said and what Bruce said. Go ahead.
Anyone else?
No.
All right. Good. Well, what I wanted to say is my girlfriend actually was adopted from a different country, actually, and she is actually an activist, and she was the founding president of her own nonprofit. I guess we have that in common. And she, so she knows a lot about adoption issues. And one thing which Bruce touched on in his wonderful introduction was what it must have been like to have your child taken away. You know, you've been through this traumatic process of giving birth, you know, lots of physical pain, and you've got all of these hormones, these love hormones in your body, and you're ready to bond with your child, and then you're told you're never ever going to see them. You're told that that you're never going to see them, that they're deformed, and they have birth defects, and that just sounds so traumatic to her. And she just stuffed that emotion because apparently, according to my girlfriend, Jen, this is the way that it was done back in the 50s, or much more common, where the mother wouldn't even get a chance to see the child and grieve the loss of the child that, you know, they had been bonding with for 9 months. And so a lot of people so that could potentially be a source of the rage of TMS, is not having any involvement in that choice, not being assaulted. Another one might be control issues, that a lot of adoptees and adoptive parents face control issues. Often within that community, it's understood that it's just as hard, if not harder, on the birth mother than it is on the adopted child, because the birth mother has to give up their own child, and the shame and the guilt that comes with that for some people. Not that it should necessarily, just that's what they often feel. And so I thought that maybe that, it just reminded me when I was hearing Bruce talk about how she got involved in her children and her grandchildren's life, maybe that was another expression of her need to have some control, because she hadn't had any control, maybe over what happened to Alexa, but definitely over what happened to Stephen. Just a thought.
That was a good one. That was a good thought. There's some more questions there. What would you do? Forrest, was the next one. Is it okay if I go to that?
Please, absolutely. Thank you.
Again, like I said, before I learned about the knowledge that we're speaking about now, it was like, what would you do? Well, I wrote down there nothing. I would just let it permeate my, you know, my body, and just get in my body. Little did I know that all that tense of thinking and all that trying to, you know, not face it was hurting me, and, you know, actually laid me down into the bed. But I'm thinking about, you know, Miss R, and she went through it for 40 years, and then after that, I think it took another 13 years for to get the full resolution. But just by her second time she went to the therapist, she was already feeling better. And knowledge to know what we've never been taught, like what we're talking about right now, mm-hmm. is just so powerful, because I wrote down there nothing, and I was 39 years old, and I was allowing these thoughts to be in my mind, but I didn't know what to do with them. Mm-hmm. And they were there, and I knew they were back there. I just didn't want to mess with them, because I thought that's the way it's supposed to be, in, as in a belief system, you know. And like Bruce was saying, her sister falls out a window, and she feels that she's got to take care of her, and like you said, and then the rage is there. And But, you know, if you don't know this on how to reverse or how to talk or go to a therapist, then what happens is you sit there and you do nothing about it. You sit there and just keep going through it. And thank God for, you know, Dr. Sarno and his therapist in this in these talks, you know.
Well, the mental chatter gets to be so overwhelming, it suckers you in.
Wow.
You start to believe in the identity of these fragmented characters inside your head, and they're serving their purpose. They're distracting you from the underlying emotions that are repressed in mind-body. I just had a perception that the reason my TMS pain goes away when I'm riding my bicycle is because that's when I'm feeling my body without that mental chatter going on. There's no room for it if you're actually got your consciousness projected into your muscles and your breathing and so on. It's like it serves that kind of purpose, that therapeutic purpose that you get in somatization.
I noticed that in my workout yesterday. I noticed that I had been meditating so much on the calm ratio, you know, and I've been working so much all week, and you know, just through regular labor work or whatever, mind work, what you get, you can get tension through that, and I knew I had to relieve some and get it out of my body. And when I got out there and started working out, like what Bruce mentioned, I started feeling this overall good feeling going through my body, and it was pretty awesome.
Yeah, just feeling your legs and your arms and your core, and not having any of that mental chatter going on, not working with it, or having it work with you.
Yes.
It's quite a relief.
A lot of times it would actually talk me out of going and doing a good workout or something. And
exactly. Yeah. That it serves its purpose, too, as distraction.
Yes. And, you know, again, it goes right back to me writing down on what would you do. Before I knew all this knowledge, nothing. I was stuck. I was stuck in the corner, even though I'd been studying mind and body for years and years and years, I wouldn't have done nothing because I had never been told the Sarnoian way. Is that the way you say that for us, the Sarnoian?
The Sarno way, whatever?
Yeah, the Sarno way. Okay, that'll work, yeah. Thank God, you know, for these therapists and Sherman and Anderson. And this is just an awesome book. It's going to really reveal a lot through our talks here.
Yeah, yeah. I totally, what you're saying is when you say about what would you do when you do nothing, I mean, I think that it's been understood by psychologists in the last 40 or 50 years that there is a process of grieving for anything that you have to go through, and you can't skip steps, you got to do it. It reminded me a lot, maybe someone else can remind me of what this was in Eric Sherman's portion. He talked about how there was someone, maybe it was the one who had two deaths early in their life, one of those case histories that we covered earlier, who just didn't know how to handle all of that trauma, and it was too much for their young brains, their young coping skills to handle, and so they just shut down and they stuffed it into the unconscious. You know, I think reading these case histories is helping me understand about how the unconscious is still connected to the body. So you stuff it down into your unconscious and into your body, and it just sits there waiting for, you know, that scab to be pulled off later on, or waiting for the reservoir of unconscious emotion to boil over. And I can totally relate to that. Because, I mean, I think that's a lot of what I deal with and what the source of my TMS is. I mentioned earlier that my mother died when I was young, and I think that I didn't have the tools to deal with that at all. And so I stuffed it, and I kind of retreated into my logical brain. It's something that I've been discovering. I mean, in my personal TMS journey, I got over my symptoms pretty easily, and I beat those symptoms, but occasionally I still have other things which I identify as TMS, and I kind of know that I have more work to do to get in touch with those emotions, to really get to the place where I want to be. And I think that's what happened a lot with Fran's patients, is that they came to her and then they got better. I think that's what happened with Ellen. She got better within a month or a couple months or a year, but she kept on going for 8 more years because she realized that there was more going on, that the TMS had been like a canary in the coal mine, and she wanted to do more work. But when I reflect on my own personal work that I want to do going forward, this story really resonated with me, because I feel like I am often out of touch with my own emotional reactions, that I learned really early on, when the emotion was overwhelming, to kind of retreat into my logical brain and not to necessarily be in touch with the emotion. So I can relate to Mrs. R's alexithymia, which is quite striking. Alexithymia, for those who aren't familiar with the term, just means no words for feelings. A means no, lex means words, thymia means feelings. People with alexithymia can't talk about their feelings because they don't even know that they're feeling them. The research on alexithymia has shown that people with alexithymia often get mind-body conditions, and so it's a major source of research into mind-body conditions. And you can see in this story, Fran treating someone with alexithymia. And it feels like that's a lot of what we've responded to as we've read this story, is how tough it was for us to read it, given how alexithymic she was, because we knew that there must be strong things going on for her, but she had no clue.
She didn't have a clue about the death of the horse, Robbie, having to put it to sleep, or the fact that she got Robbie at the time that Steve died. This whole psychodrama was not available to her. And Dr. Anderson notices that Mrs. R's tone of voice and the way she reports things, we know that her objective way of reporting is a style that helps her distance herself from emotions that she does not want to experience fully. And that seemed to be her coping style there for, what, 40 years of her life.
Yes.
She'd been cool. It's like that James Dean pose, isn't it? Where a kid is cool because he's really insecure about growing up, about fitting into the adult world, so he adopts this pose, being cool. And the same thing with Mrs. R. She's been cool for 40 years about Stephen and about Alexa, while these feelings have been boiling inside of her, while she adopts this method of neutral reportage and a pseudo-objectivity, I call it, where that creates a distance from emotions that are threatening, overwhelming. It's like style with a writer. Fictionalized accounts in a novel, too, where you're working through your feelings by creating fiction and hypothetical situations to play them out. It's a safety valve.
Yeah, like when she's taking care of everybody, you know, to make up for the feelings that's on the inside of her. So she takes care of people, and she wants to make sure that they're took well care of, and she feels like that's a vindication, sort of, I believe. If she does that, then it'll make up for things that's been done in the past. Often.
Compensation.
Sorry.
Yeah. Or even a distraction. I hear that voice, so we're going to get to you. Or even a distraction. I've definitely seen people on the forum or talk to them on the phone, and it feels like sometimes us TMSers, we become a bundle of energy focusing on something else so that we don't have to face our emotions. That sometimes, and maybe that's what's happening with Mrs. R, is she becomes a bundle of energy doing all of these projects, so to distract her. It's part of the whole distraction thing.
Yeah. She came to one of the meetings, and she, I think there at the end, she had done already gotten real athletic and in shape, real good. And at the end, it looked like everything. Well, it didn't look like it was. Everything had turned out perfect. It took a minute, but yeah, like you said earlier, Forrest, you know, getting rid of the symptoms was the first thing, but it's the journey, you know, and staying on it and making sure that you get that complete resolution. Because I've heard that saying before, where somebody comes back a year later and the pain's back. And sometimes I wonder if they kept the maintenance up, you know. Mm-hmm. And after we learn how to face our repressions, then we gotta stay on that journey. And this is the story of that journey.
That's me. I'm back. I cured myself about 5 years ago, and about 8 months ago, the pain came back five times as worse and more in more places in my body than it was the first time. And I didn't do any maintenance. So I am a perfect example of that, and I'm still working on it.
Well, we're glad you're here with us, and we're glad you're doing that maintenance, because you know what? We're all doing it. We're all staying at that maintenance, and overall, it makes you feel good, you know?
Yeah. Well said, Eric. Dr. Sarno did say it was a lifelong condition. I'm feeling bad about this person who called my name twice earlier in the call. Did you want to jump in?
Yes,
let's give you the floor.
Can you hear
me?
We
sure can. Yeah.
This is Joan. I'm a former Sarno patient.
Oh, congratulations. Oh, thanks for jumping in.
And I actually met Dr. Sarno in the city. Had severe back pain. And I'm cured of that about 6 years ago. And I've been on the wiki chat, and maybe you know who I am, but I have severe jaw pain where I feel that I am just stuck, and I don't know what to do to take that next step. With all that I know, I am just stuck. So I don't know if anyone could jump in and...
You're looking for help, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this, it's actually seems to tie into exactly what we're talking about. And I can relate to that, where I feel like when I deal with practitioners, one theme which I run a mailing list for TMS therapists, and I help organize conferences. One theme that you hear a lot from the practitioner is it's vital to figure out the underlying stuff. One of the things about book cures, people who heal themselves quite successfully by reading and rereading, and just accepting the diagnosis, is what if there's something psychologically underneath that hasn't been fixed that's going to come back someday eventually. And I think that may be, the relapses like that, I think, are tough. Often they're a different symptom, totally unrelated to the original one. But when it comes back, it's a little bit scarier, and it's time to do a little bit deeper work, and often you have to focus on your habits of mind and really fix them this time. You have to think about where your tension is. Does anyone have any thoughts for Joan?
Just stay course.
It's come back, and I'm still working on it, but I'm working with a therapist this time. Last time I did it myself.
Right.
So... hopefully, I'll get better, deeper.
You said you're working with Arnold Block. Is that the person you're working with?
Yes.
A good thing. A good thing.
Awesome.
Well, thank you.
Excuse me. My name is Ann Joy, and I've been doing this Sarno thing, not with anybody, but, you know, on my own for a long, long time. And I've had many, many things. It's never a matter of coming back, like the old thing, like, say, for example, if I had back pain, that it doesn't come back for any length of time, because now I know what it is, so there's not a lot of point to it. But something new pops up, and at first I thought, or for quite a while I thought, I sort of felt like a failure, at this TMS thing, but I realized that I just had to keep scratching at the surface. You know, you can't dig too fast or you really can do a lot of harm there, but I had to keep scratching away at it, you know, just digging below the surface to see what else would come up. And I just wanted to say about this story of Mrs. R, I've been sort of sitting in the background wondering what on earth to say about this, because I had a really visceral reaction in a way. I didn't like Mrs. R much, and I wasn't too crazy about the therapist, and I thought, you know, what's going on with this? Because it was too strong, too judgmental a reaction for it to be just based on the few words that we read. I mean, I'm usually quite a sympathetic person, and I usually feel that people have their right standing feelings that they have. It's not my judgment call, but there I was judging away, and I just realized, listening to everyone, it came to me that Mrs. R reminds me very much of my mother, who was very rigid. Yeah, you laugh.
No.
Well, it's funny, you know, but the funny part is, it's, you know, she, that is even her name, Mrs. R, my mother. But anyway, she was far. She didn't come from a wealthy family, and she didn't have nannies and all that jazz. But she wanted to, and she and my dad got themselves quite rich a few times through hard work and determination, and then they would lose it through stupidity, and you know, they just sort of kind of flipped back and forth during my childhood, and I watched all this ambition going on, and something about what Mrs. R was doing really resonated. It was like she's faking, you know, fake it till you make it. That's a saying that
I've you hit it on the head.
Never been crazy about, you know. And I guess that's what it was, is that I just felt like I felt like she was not, I mean, after 8 years of therapy, for heaven's sake, she still hadn't really addressed any real questions. Now, you know, I mean, it's not up to me to know what she should have done in her therapy, but for goodness sake, you know, don't you eventually have to stop worrying about how you look to everybody and think about who you are, you know? I mean,
I thought Mrs. R was just incredibly bourgeois.
Yeah, exactly. No kidding. Yeah, and my mother was trying to be incredibly bourgeois, because she was sort of, you know, upwardly mobile. You know, I mean, her grandfather.
That's the American dream.
And you know, but yeah, there they are, and to spend 8 years in therapy, and to come to the conclusion that you're a caring person and you look after animals because you weren't able to care for your disabled son. Well, I mean, that's kind of slim pickings, isn't it, for 8 years? Like, why did she let her husband do that to her? And I was I was there in the 50s, and trust me, lots of women would have said, what the hell do you think you're doing? You know, this is my kid too. Who do you think you are? Stop
that. Well, remember the question we had about Ellen last time. Why in the heck did she pick out Ted, the abusive partner, just because of her sibling rivalry with her elder brother? It seemed like these people aren't making conscious choices. Their psychology is making choices for them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but isn't that true of us all, Bruce? I mean,
what I was going to say.
That's what I was talking about with myself.
Well, the Greek philosopher Heraclitus said, "Character estin moira," a man's character is his fate. He said that, you know, 500 years before the birth of Christ.
Wow.
These things have been observed before.
And that's why one part of me saying, Mike, you know, what are you talking about? You don't have any right to judge this woman. But on the other hand, I'm thinking, good Lord, grow a pair. I mean, that seems like a funny thing. A woman, but, you know, I mean, really, you know, really, to just, I worked as a youth care worker at one time, and I once had a young client whose mom was like that, and she would say things like, I never lie down during the day because that would be letting myself go, right, and stuff like that, and I was thinking, oh, for pity's sake, people. You know, I mean, don't you, like, isn't the first person that you, like, isn't the, you have to let go a little bit of your insistence on controlling everything. And the place to start is with yourself, you know. I mean, she insisted on, as far as I could tell, Mrs. R. insisted on controlling everybody around her in her own particular way. Like, she did things for people that did not need doing, you know. I mean, she looked after everybody. She looked after everybody, and it was a way of not looking after herself, not letting
extreme disconnect that Dr. Anderson notices between thinking and feeling in her patients. I wonder what it is about TMS patients and dogs, though. Do they have a strange way of entering their dream life? Is this a way of projecting this this nostalgia for a more vital, humanized self? With Mrs. R, it's the Riemeriners. But as Anderson observes, Mrs. R is emotionally spontaneous with her dogs and loves them because they are so directly expressive of their feelings. Mm-hmm. Obviously something she is not, especially their affection. They do not resist expressing feelings. They are not embarrassed or ashamed, which must mean, conversely, that Mrs. R is embarrassed or ashamed about her mm-hmm. feelings, about having feelings, period. Mm-hmm. Something yeah. about her, the diktat of her bourgeois upbringing, this upwardly socially mobile ambition, makes her do this.
Did she? But she felt like she was because her sister, you know, Alexa again. She felt like it was her fault when mm-hmm. she fell. I don't know. I didn't get the age that she was at that time.
She was 8 years old.
Eight years old. Yeah. So it was a 10.
So of course she felt responsible. You know, I mean, she was a child. They're responsible for everything, aren't they?
Yeah.
So yeah. No, I mean, I'm very sympathetic to her. I don't know why it's still bugging me. But it's just fascinating because I'm going to probably spend quite a lot of time working on this. So very grateful for the topic, actually.
So it's something, it sounds like it's really influenced you and touched you in some sense, and you're trying to figure out, okay, where is your response from?
Yeah, exactly, because I have these two sort of opposite feelings. One is sympathy and the other one is judgment, you know. And I mean, that's fine, but at some point you have to, you know, let those two things dialogue and come up with some kind of synthesis.
Absolutely. I know that when I have a response like that, sometimes if I have a really strong response, it's because maybe it reminds me of me sometimes, or reminds me of what I don't like about myself or what I want myself to be. I mean, I think I do tend to have a little bit more sympathy to Mrs. R. I don't know how to describe it, but I do. In terms of, she probably did, I don't know, I just get a sense of her feeling out of control. And it's interesting how much the word control has come up here. I had my girlfriend read most of the story to provide kind of the adoption perspective on it, and she saw an awful lot of control in there also. She saw Mrs. R's mother as being controlling, so maybe that's where it started. where maybe Mrs. R didn't feel in control. And everybody is so different. And I know that sometimes when people, I'm sure that I could tell my story and that there would be people who would say, oh, you're being so psychological, you know. and I think we just have, we all have different ways of being crazy, right?
So true.
Well, I just noticed too that Mrs. R, as Dr. Anderson comments, loves teaching dogs, the
exactly.
dogs that she admires for their spontaneous feeling, how to obey in training class. This is a metaphor for her controlling that spontaneous human part of her. Herself, she feels like she needs to keep the lid on. She admires this stuff, but yet it has to be controlled too.
Right.
Yeah, she's the dog she's training. Yeah, she's that's interesting. Wow.
Very good. Yeah. I'm glad I saw that extra sentence that I didn't highlight.
It is amazing how you go back and you see other little details. Like I always read them at least twice. Yeah.
Well, the second reading is the important one too, isn't it?
Yeah, it's rich, rich stories.
Well, the thing that makes this all so useful, too, is like you said, Forrest, we're really talking about ourselves. When we read something about Mrs. R, it's got nothing to do with Mrs. R. Mm-hmm. I mean, especially in this case, it's so removed because we're seeing it through the lens of the therapist and so on. But our reactions are pure us.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I had two repressions.
What a beautiful insight. Yeah. Tell us about that, Eric.
That was beautiful, Angela. I had two. While I was reading the story, I think I got just through page two of the story, and I'd already had something that was buried in the back of my subconscious that came to me, and I wrote it down. I'm not going to express what it was, but I wrote it down, and I was like, this is neat, and really, Angela just said, we see ourselves in there, and. There was two repressions that came to me, and it was like, well, thank God, that freed my mind up. And just by reading that story, and it's so just potent, it's so potent and full of truth. But when we read it, we're like, what's wrong with that lady, And then you look back and you start to see parts of you there. Like I was saying earlier, 2 years ago, I couldn't have looked at that and said, like the question number one, how would I feel? Like, I would have felt angry. I wouldn't have known what to do. And, again, this story is going to open a lot of doors for people that don't know what to do. Because for me, as long as I've been studying it already, and then the day to get two repressions to come to consciousness, I was like, wow. I had to go and talk to my wife about it for almost an hour.
What I've learned from reading these stories, though, and from engaging on the forum and here, is that when I go out and I listen to someone's idle chatter, like they're just talking to me in the gym for an hour or so, I pick out these salient points in their conversation that reveal so much about what they're really anxious about.
Yes.
I can focus right in on the problem.
Yes.
They're trying to sucker me into their drama.
Yeah.
I'm sitting back at a certain place and I'm going, oh, this guy just got divorced. His kid's getting to be 25.
Yes, like
now,
they don't know what they're
40-year-old
talking about.
Chick started hitting on his son, and now he's really nervous about his identity, and now he feels like he needs to make a lot of money. I hear like six little comments in the course of an hour, and I've got a summary of the person and their anxieties. And also, if they relate to my anxieties, too, right? It's like a learning process. There's a learning curve in all this. As you work on yourself, you get tools to understand other people.
Yeah, it's like it opens your eyes. It gives you a new way of viewing, and it's a wonderful thing.
Notational.
Yeah.
A notational view, where you can just extract the salient points and reach a summary, achieve a summary of of that person's anxiety at that moment in time.
Very much. Well, we call it
our perceptions. I mean, it takes a long time to do this, and different people are so complex. It's so complicated. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And our own biases and our own experiences, just as we've noticed when we're reading these case histories, is we're to some degree learning about ourselves. The same will be true, I think, as we interact with people that we meet in day-to-day life.
Yes.
I do feel, so one thing which I think is an interesting thing, which we haven't talked about, maybe will come up next week because we're running out of time, unfortunately, there's kind of a theme of money here, in the sense that these people were so lucky to be able to do this therapy for so long, and we can't, and we're very lucky to have access to that through the books. Like these are really special stories, coming from 9 or 13 years of therapy with a trained professional, someone who started with a doctorate and then got 2 additional, multi-year, accreditations after that, psychoanalyst and somatic experiencing practitioner. How does that make us feel? The fact that we may not have access to it. I thought that was interesting. Does that resonate with anyone, or am I coming up a blank here?
Well, tell you the truth, what it did for me is it made me glad I don't have the money to see a therapist because I mean, difficult as it is, and goodness knows I'm probably missing stuff that a good therapist would find, but the fact is I'm in control of my own process, and I don't have anybody going easy on me to me this was just it was too much. It really was too much. I don't see how. Like, I used to spend a lot of time as a crisis line counselor, and I trained crisis line workers and so forth. And I would have just gone crazy if I couldn't have once in a while said, "Well, have you ever thought of?"
Yeah.
I mean, she's so gentle with it.
My mother had a friend named Mrs. C, who was married to a CPA who made $400 an hour for Fortune 500 companies. Well, Mrs. C had tinnitus, and she went to therapy for 20 years trying to find someone to listen to her, and her husband would spend any amount of money on this. And it never got better. It was simply she had the money to buy people to listen to her complain about her life, and that was what therapy consisted of for her, having enough to do it, not to get better, but to become a therapy junkie because she could afford to. And
and actually, I again,
Mrs. R could afford to do these things too. That's someone who grew up in the ghetto in Point Richmond would not be able to afford this sort of.
Absolutely, but they might just never know, and they may never have the opportunity to learn. I mean, I think so. There's a theorist named Carl Rogers, and I do not know very. Ooh. I don't a complicated deep theorist, and I would not presume to be able to explain his theory, but one idea that I associate with him is the idea that the person being analyzed or the patient or the client is the one who knows the proper pace. And the stuff which is being dealt with is so deeply repressed here that I kind of wonder if you push it, if you push too fast, do you just go deeper into repression? But I do have to say, one of the wonderful things about us working with the journals is that because you'll never find a more motivated person than someone in pain. Like we want to get fixed, and we want to get fixed now.
Great.
And we do have a sense of where the real work is to be done, like where we need to go. It feels like this is a very deep concept, and I don't want to wrap up. Let's give us maybe 5 more minutes so we can talk about this a little bit more.
I was getting better really fast, and I was letting all my emotions out, and what you said really hit me just in terms of you go too fast and you go deeper into repression, because that's what I've done in the past week. All the pains have come back, and I was getting really better, and I had all my range of motion back, and I was feeling better about myself, and then I had problems with my accountant and my taxes and all that, and everything came back. Everything came back, and I haven't been able to let go. So, yeah, there's a problem with going too fast, and I've only been working only for, like, a few weeks with a therapist, and he takes insurance, so it's not a question of affordability.
Well, thank you for adding that, because I think so Dr. Anderson, I think, talks about this explicitly in the story. One thing which she has talked about, I think, in this book and elsewhere, is that some of the other theorists who have influenced her a lot talk a lot about how when there is a psychosomatic condition, you never know what that's protecting, and there's a situation where you need to go very slowly. And so, you know, as you do delve in, I think everybody has a different pace, and I think Dr. Anderson is very good at establishing containment where the emotions can be explored, and they go at a pace where the defense mechanisms will not click in and sidetrack you.
That's what's happening with me right now. I'm full of pain like I never started. But I know that that's temporary, and I know that I don't know how to get over it.
Yeah, I think it's important to do pacing well, to kind of listen to what your body is telling you, and make sure that you're ready. I think a lot of people will zoom in, and they'll try to ask the big questions before they're really ready for the true answers to the big questions, and they'll get an answer which they believe, but may not be the deepest answer or the best answer that they could get. I don't know. I mean, I wish I knew more. I think the psychotherapeutic process is still...
That sounds very right to me.
It seems like the answers to the big questions, though, are so simple as to be shocking. And you try and be clever in your analysis at first. And it's really something very obvious that you aren't addressing. And it would be apparent to a therapist, objective third person. Well, it would be apparent to people around you, even your friends. They'd say, "Oh, that's what's going on," you know.
Right. Yes. And to her, she don't see it, and it's subconscious. It's there. She doesn't want to face it, and it's. The therapist leads her through it a little at a time, like Forrest said, so the defense mechanism won't you know, keep her from allowing to be able to get to her curing point, you know?
Yeah, it's like Dr. Anderson says that Mrs. R. could not permit herself to think of Stephen or to feel anger at Alexa or anyone close to her. This led to a buildup of rage in her reservoir, spilling over into physical symptoms. That's why she was so devoted to caring for others, too, so she wouldn't have to face these things. And Dr. Anderson says it's unacknowledged guilt really driving the whole thing about not being able to take care of Stephen. And she had to pull off layer by layer by layer to get to that. Although it was probably quite obvious from their first session with that remarkable
how she
improved so much.
Dr. Anderson talks about how hard and how much she has to hold back, and I suspect that's a common thing for a therapist, where I think we read this story and we're frustrated because we can see some things. And to some degree, it's the way that Dr. Anderson sets it up, so that she's concentrating on the most important stuff. But we can see some things, and we're like, why doesn't she get it? But I know that if I were in therapy, it would probably be just as frustrating, if not more frustrating, for my therapist at how slow and how dumb I was being. Maybe that's just the way it goes, is that, you know, it's... The unconscious mind is as powerful tools to deceive us. And I mean, I think one of the lessons that I took away from this chapter is the importance of patience, and I guess how frustrating it all can be to try and do the true deep work to get to the bottom of it.
So healing just takes time.
I guess. I don't know. I don't know if there's a magic bullet. We all want magic bullets. I don't know. What do others think?
Well, you know, she couldn't say no to anybody. And that, I mean, that was obvious that when you read the story. But again, it just keeps the reservoir boiling until you actually find out that, you know, she didn't know she couldn't. She knew she couldn't say no, but she didn't know why. She just couldn't stop it, you know. She didn't know why, and eventually the therapist took her to the cure.
Took her there. All right. Well, great. This has certainly been a thought-provoking story. Perhaps we will come back to it. Perhaps we will all reread this book in a couple years and have new insights into it.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you for your take on you know, from the point of view of somebody who's been in extensive therapy, because I've never really had that opportunity. And what little I've seen of psychiatrists, psychologists, and counselors and so on, I haven't been all that impressed, but maybe that's more my personality than anything else. So I really appreciate your point of view. Thank you.
Well, my pleasure, and thank you for sharing your point of view. I think, you know, we're all going to have, we all have these reactions, and I think that's what this group is about processing those reactions and learning from each other and, you know, continuing that process of growth and kind of growing through our condition, making the most of it, turning
it
into an opportunity.
It seems like we did get to all of the salient points of this story, though. I didn't think we could... achieve that in an hour.
It was a deep story. It was longer than I remember. Okay, so for next week, shall we do, I think it's Mrs. T. We'll do the next story, the one where she does that brief encounter. I'm not sure who it is, but we'll do the next
little
story.
Little Kate.
Little Kate.
Yeah,
there you go. Okay. Well, thank you all so much for participating, both the talkers and the listeners. It has been wonderful to have you here, and I know I've learned a lot from each of you, and I look forward to chatting next week. Thanks again so much for we are now up to four co-hosts. Bruce, Enjoy, Eric, Becca is our producer. Thank you all so much, and I think we're building something cool here, and I look forward to our future discussions.